From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today, what's the new state budget mean for Michigan colleges and universities?
Tuition's going up all over the state. U of M is up by about 1.6%, and MSU's aggregate increase is about 2.8%.
How should politicians win over young voters?
If they can start engaging us, wanting voters, on Twitter, Facebook, even Instagram, and they can kind of communicate back, I think that's going to really change our attitude about the cynicism and about our doubts about politics and about politicians themselves.
And bet you didn't know this about Michigan's cherry farms.
In some years, you have as much as one half or more of cherries produced in Michigan just rotting on the ground.
Those stories and much more today on Stateside. There are over 80 million millennials in the United States, larger than any other generation. Those 18 to 34-year-olds could have a huge impact on politics in the U.S. That's if they get out to vote. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today on Stateside, we dig into what issues will get millennials to the polls and what political campaigns should do to get their votes. Then, Michigan author Roberta King will share the story of her son's life with cerebral palsy in her new memoir, He Plays a Harp.
It's a joy to me to bring him to people that never knew him. And I think through that, I feel a little less of the loss.
That's later this hour. But first, continuing our look at how the new state budget will affect Michigan. Yesterday was K through 12 education. Today, higher education. Jake Neer is Lansing reporter for the Michigan Public Radio Network. And Jake, everyone who writes a tuition check has one question. Is tuition going up? Continuing our look at how the new state budget will affect Michigan. Yesterday was K through 12 education. Today, higher education. Jake Neer is Lansing reporter for the Michigan Public Radio Network. And Jake, everyone who writes a tuition check has one question. Is tuition going up?
And the answer would be yes. Tuition's going up all over the state. U of M and MSU have been able to keep the hikes a little bit lower than other universities. U of M is up by about 1.6%, and MSU's aggregate increase is about 2.8%. Lawmakers have set a limit on where universities, where they can't increase tuition more than 3.2%, or they'll lose that additional access to state aid. But now most major universities other than U of M and MSU are going right up to that cap in this year's tuition increases. So they're all going up to 3.2%. And that's something I don't think that budget leaders in the legislature are too happy about, given the governor just approved the largest increase in state aid for higher ed in years.
How much does the new state budget give to higher ed, Jake?
Oh, the new state budget increases higher ed spending by about 5.9%.
And how does that compare? Is that a pretty good jump from previous years?
Well, Michigan has seen a kind of a long kind of history in recent years of declining state aid to universities. The governor sort of wants to get that level of funding for universities and college up to where it was before he took office. In that first year, in 2011, there was a big major reduction in the state budget for universities and colleges. So now, the state is trying to make up for that. And again, that 5.9% increase is one of the biggest ones we've seen in recent years.
Speaking of tuition increases, Michigan State University is going to go with a two-tiered tuition increase. What is that and why are they doing it?
Yeah, well, MSU is raising tuition more for juniors and seniors than for freshmen and sophomores. So the university says that's because it costs more to educate juniors and seniors because they typically have smaller class sizes with more specialized and experienced professors. Of course, some will say that they basically just want to attract students to campus, and then once they're there, the costs will go up more. I've heard it compared to what the cable companies do, pay this low rate for the first 6 months, and then they jack up the rates after that.
Speaking of the Spartans, MSU was in danger, Jake, of $500,000, we'll call it a spanking from state lawmakers because they were offering courses about organized labor. What was so wrong with that? Who led that charge?
Well, there was a lot of controversy surrounding this, more than I think lawmakers who proposed this even were expecting. Basically, what happened there was the university was facilitating this program of sort of seminars for companies that were looking at unionizing, or actually the labor forces there that were looking at how to unionize and how to organize and so forth. And of course, with a Republican majority in the legislature, that came off as an issue for them, obviously. And so now with a lot of sort of backlash for this $500,000 penalty that was originally proposed, they kind of had to back down and say, well, you know, the university is dealing with this issue. We expect them to, you know, basically handle it and make sure that they're doing it in an appropriate fashion. So it was something that just led to a lot of controversy, and they sort of just had to back down from that.
So the money stayed in MSU's funding.
That's correct. They're not going to face any penalties because of that per program that they were facilitating.
Also, I want to talk to you about the increase in funding for the Michigan Tuition Grant Program. How much is that going to be?
Well, that's going to be pretty much the same increase as what the state is doing for higher ed in general, the 5.9% increase. And this affects students that are in need, in financial need, that would want to go to private colleges. So the thought behind this was that, you know, for students who didn't have the financial means to pay for private education in higher ed, this would give them more choice to do that.
So if we were grading the amount of money in the state budget, would we give it an A, B, C, D, or failing?
I'm going to do what most politicians do when they duck questions, and that's the incomplete, right? They say that, again, the governor, like I said, wants to get the funding percentage up to, you know, or the total funding up to where he was before he took office. So this is going to be an ongoing discussion, and it's something that he definitely wants to keep working on. The one question for me, again, is with all these universities increasing their tuition up to the full 3.2%, right up to that cap, whether or not they're going to burn some bridges in the legislature in some way.
Jake Neer, Lansing reporter for the Michigan Public Radio Network. Thanks, Jake.
Thanks, Cindy.
Michigan and cherries are one and the same. So why were 30 million pounds of tart cherries left to rot on the ground, much of those from Michigan? Ron French is with Bridge Magazine. Ron, this seems just nuts. What's happening here?
Kind of crazy, isn't it, Cindy?
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, there are a lot of crazy sort of Byzantine rules that are involved with the cherry industry that are not involved in the apple industry or the grape industry. It's really based on some old rules that have never been removed.
What are those rules?
Well, the cherry industry, because so much of the product, the tart cherry industry, is all produced in such a small area, the weather can have a vast impact on the nation's produce. And so what the USDA tries to do, the U.S. Department of Agriculture, is tries to level out the availability of cherries by setting limits on how many cherries can actually make it to market. And so every year, it's called the Cherry Board, actually. It's a board made up of cherry growers and cherry producers get together and say, this is the amount of cherries we're going to allow to get to market so that the prices don't plunge. And what the result of that is that in some years you have as much as one half or more of cherries produced in Michigan just rotting on the ground.
Why are there no restrictions, Ron French, on cherries grown, let's say, in Oregon or Pennsylvania or imported cherries? Why is it Michigan?
It's politics. When this law was the most recent version of these tart cherry restrictions were put into place, there were two senators, one from Pennsylvania, Arlen Specter, and one from Oregon named Mark Hatfield, who were influential in the Senate, and they managed to get their states excluded from this. There's no farm reason for it. There's no cherry reason for it. It's purely politics as to why a tart cherry grower in Pennsylvania can grow as many as he wants, but in Michigan they cannot.
And we should be clear, we're not talking about the sweet cherries, the ones that we can eat like candy. So farmers can't even say, hey, friends, I've got bags of cherries to give you.
Absolutely. These are not farmers who are setting up stands along the side of the road. These tart cherries are tart. They're used as a food product, as an ingredient. That they're what are used in cherry pies, cherry juice, cherries that you find inside baked goods usually are tart cherries. And so they really, these farmers have to sell their produce to cherry processors. And there are plenty of them around. It's just that the processors can only sell a certain number of cherries that they take in.
And Elk Rapids Food Processing Company is suing the USDA over all of this. On what grounds, and what are they hoping will happen?
Their hope is to remove the restrictions completely. They feel it's unfair to some producers, such as Michigan producers, more than others, and they also feel it's unfair to different kinds of processors. I'll make this as short as possible, but it's complicated even for me, for cherry growers, but processors who freeze tart cherries have no problem with the restrictions because they can freeze them and keep them for 3 or 4 years. And at some point, there's going to be a down year in cherries, and they can just sell what they've stored. But cherry processors that can cherries, that's what you see at when you go to Meijer and buy a can of cherry pie filling. That has a shelf life of 1 year. So if there were restrictions placed on processors who produce cherry pie filling, they can run out of product in a year.
But tart cherry growers and processors actually had a chance to get rid of those market restrictions earlier this year, and 3/4 of them voted to keep the restrictions?
Yeah, absolutely. That's what makes this so complicated. It's a system that works. It keeps cherry producers in business. It also, and some will say, keeps a lot of them from getting rich, though. As it was described to me, it knocks the peaks and valleys off of prices, but it particularly knocks off the peaks. Cherry prices have not gone up to any extent in the last 20 years. So cherry growers are muddling along, and most of them are happy just to stay in business.
What's next, Ron, in this tart cherry war?
That's a good way to put it. Actually, it's a lawsuit that's being heard in Washington at the USDA. The first administrative judge who heard it removed the restrictions for cherry canners, but not for cherry freezers, if that makes any sense. But that ruling has been stayed now, so cherry farmers are going to have to continue to figure out what to do by listening to these restrictions for now.
Ron French, Bridge Magazine writer, talking cherries with us. Thanks, Ron.
Thank you.
I'm Cynthia Canty, and this is Stateside. His name was Noah. He was born with cerebral palsy, and when he was 17, he lost his battle against the infections that had ravaged his lungs. Noah's mother, Roberta King, is from West Michigan, and she shares the story of her son's life in her new memoir, He Plays a Harp.
I love talking about Noah. I could talk about him all the live long day, and the book as well. And so it's a joy to me to bring him to people that never knew him. And I think through that, I feel a little less of the loss.
Now, you said you didn't intend to write this book, but this started as you were searching for a response to that oh-so-typical question, hey, how many kids do you have?
It is. And I found that question to be very vexing, and even still to this day, I'm more comfortable with it than I was. And the question is, well, how many kids do you have? Well, we had Noah, who had lived till he was 17 and then died, and then we had his sister. So people would say, well, how many kids do you have? And I'd be like, well, two. And then the question would be, well, how old are they? Well, after Noah had been gone a couple of years, they were both 17. Oh, are they twins? Well, no, you know, and it just got really complicated because there's nothing that is a buzzkill to a conversation with a stranger than, yeah, I have two kids and one died.
Boom.
Boom. Exactly.
So you wrote a piece on the fifth anniversary of Noah's death, and that
did.
Ultimately led to this book?
Yes. The fifth anniversary of his death. I wanted to do something to mark that date. I'm kind of one of those, you know, date marking kind of people. Anniversaries, holidays, all those kinds of things.
You're talking to one. I get that.
I just
3 years ago today, we were.
Yeah, exactly. And so I wrote an essay about, you know, his actual death and the bravery of him when he chose to die. And he was in the hospital for a couple of weeks and had been quite ill. And we thought he was doing better. And his doctor said, no, the CO2 in his lungs from this lung infection is really rising. And I don't think it's going to be very long. And that day he made the decision to pass. And my husband and I were with him in the hospital. We took him from earth to heaven in our belief. And so from that, I wanted to tell that story because not a lot of people, a lot of parents experience the birth of their children, but gratefully, not very many experience the death. And I wanted people to know what that was like to walk your child from one place to another.
And that's how your book opens, your book, He Plays a Harp. And you take us right there with that last health crisis and your honesty and willingness to share the things that you and your husband Mike said to your son as he passed is exactly how you pull us in as readers. You open the book with that.
Thank you.
That was a conscious choice, I'm sure. You didn't start with, well, he was born at and work your way to this. You take us back there toward the end of the book. But
yes.
Talk about you hit your reader over the head by a 2x4. You got us.
You know, I think in structuring it, I knew that if people basically knew it was a book about a child that had died, we needed to get that part taken care of. And so I told that story first to pull the reader in. And then I was at a writing workshop in Iowa City at the Iowa Writers Summer Writers Festival a couple of years before this book came out. And one of the instructor in my class said, well, for people to – he'd read this original kind of first chapter draft, and he said for people to really care about this book, they need to care about Noah. They need to meet Noah and to know him. And so I structured it so we pulled people in. They weren't going to be able to walk away. I wanted them to know about Noah after this death scene. So get that out of the way. And then I chose to tell these stories from his life.
Yes, and you are really, really honest and frank about how you and your husband had to come to terms with Noah's challenges once he was diagnosed with CP, which was when how old?
He was about 6 months old.
About 6 months old. I'd like, if you would, to ask you to read us an excerpt from your book. And this is where a fourth grade teacher had kind of broken your bubble. You've been reading to Noah. You really wanted to give him that gift of being able to read. And she has just told you Noah just didn't have the capacity to put this all together and read.
That is correct. So this comes from a chapter titled Reading Aloud. She was right. Noah never learned to read. He never learned to do math or science or geography either. His cerebral palsy that came with his premature birth went beyond the physical and affected his ability to learn. His verbal skills were limited, too. He only spoke in simple sentences, asked basic questions, and presented rudimentary ideas in our conversation. By medical definition, he had severe cognitive and physical impairments. But he never felt that way to us. It even feels odd for me to write these words now, because all we saw in Noah was intelligence, keen observation skills, personal charm, and a fine sense of humor. The emotional disappointment of disability nibbled at me throughout his life. It was bothersome, but never overwhelming. Certainly, I felt a sense of loss and sadness, because no matter what anyone says, kids with disabilities have both societal and personal constraints in their lives that present large and sometimes overwhelming challenges. His disability, though, was never about giving up on our expectations for his life. It was about changing those expectations and learning as he grew that his life wouldn't be ordinary. My pragmatic side didn't allow for whining, wishing, or wondering about how this might play out in the future. We couldn't change Noah or fix what wasn't quite right, so we flexed our life around him and what he could do.
That is writer Roberta King of West Michigan of Muskegon reading from her new book, He Plays a Harp, a memoir, the story of her son Noah's life. He was 17 when he lost his battle against infections that had ravaged his lungs. He had been living with cerebral palsy his entire life. And you take us through his life, which you really did keep active and rich. He was at therapeutic horseback riding lessons. There was the camp in the UP that meant so much to all of you. You clearly, as you were telling the story of your life with your son Noah, that entailed some, I'm sure, what were very careful choices. And you share with us some very, very, very frank moments in the book. You talk about discovering your son's first pubic hairs when you're giving him a bath and realizing he's becoming a teenager. You talk about who had cleanup duty after bowel movements. And can you talk a little bit about why you decided that it was worth sharing those extremely intimate moments?
I felt that when I did my first draft of the book and I shared it with some friends of mine and readers as well, I mean people that didn't know Noah and just some people who were good readers, that I one of the pieces of feedback I got from a very good friend of mine who did know Noah said, if I were to read this book, I would never know that Noah was disabled. She said, you write him like he's just kind of an ordinary kid. You know, I mean, he talked about the wheelchair and all those kinds of things. So I went back and revisited it to make it an honest book. I think that when you're going to write good creative nonfiction, you have to, or memoir, you have to be really honest with yourself and with your audience, because otherwise you're kind of writing fiction or something else. And to make it as good as I could make it, I really had to be honest about all those parts of life and to make it interesting for a reader. Otherwise, it's just like raising another kid, you know? And so, and some of those things like, you know, the first pubic hair and all the toilet stories and things like that become kind of family legend. They become kind of, you know, fun family stories.
But was there any concern of trotting on Noah's privacy in this?
You know, I'm hoping he's forgiving me for all that. I actually, you know, I thought about a piece of the story about the pubic hair was written and published prior to the memoir in a magazine called online magazine called Brainchild, mm-hmm. the Journal for Thinking Mothers. And I published it there, and I thought to myself, I wonder what Noah would think about this. And then I thought, I think he'd think it was funny because he had a really good sense of humor. And our family has always been kind of, when you have a kid with a disability and you're, you know, dealing with all these sort of human frailties and openness, you just tend to be a little less probably private than the rest of the world. And so I'm hoping that he thinks it's funny and as funny as we do.
What do you hope that other families who are facing similar kinds of challenges, whatever that may be, what do you hope they might learn from what your family went through?
I think that it's really about love, and it's about accepting what life has given you and doing your very best with it. And once you learn that you can't change what has happened or what is going to happen, you just have to manage on, and you have to be brave and bold and do what's best for you and your child. And in the first chapter I talk about how my husband and I opted to sign do not resuscitate orders for our son. He had this lung infection that by reading the book you would know he was not curable. It came from not a virus or a bacteria, but from aspirating bits of food and water over about an 18-month period, and the infection could not be cured. And we, every time we had to put him on a ventilator or suction him, he was unhappy, he was miserable, he was fearful, he cried. And it got to a point where we knew that was what his life was going to be like. They told us if he went home from the hospital, he would never leave the house, which meant he wouldn't go back to high school. Mm. Couldn't do that. He loved to go out and eat with us and do all those kinds of things. And we could not let that happen. And so we made the tough decision. And as I say in the book, we never told Noah because we didn't want him to think that we didn't love him enough. But we also didn't want him to live a miserable housebound, hospital-bound existence, because that wasn't what he had for the first 16 years of his life.
You loved him enough to let him go so he didn't have to face the vents and the suctioning and all of that.
Absolutely.
The book is He Plays a Harp, a memoir. Roberta King of Muskegon is the mother who is the author of the book, the story of her son Noah's life. Thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you for having me.
A rainy vacation would put most of us in a very grumpy mood. But for one couple, a rainy holiday on Mackinac Island turned into inspiration for a new board game they call Mackinac Island Treasure Hunt. Creators Barbara Overdeer and Jim Moratsky are here. Jim, tell us about the moment that you and Barbara came up with this idea.
In this case, we were out in the woods and thinking about, you know, what's a good way for to see, have other people see what's happening out here, because I think a lot of people are used to just visiting the downtown part of Mackinac Island and not really getting out into the state park area, which we find, you know, pretty fascinating. And it was, you know, I mean, the Mackinac Island's kind of a distillation of all of the things that are fascinating about northern Michigan and the Great Lakes. I mean, when you talk about the geological history, the human history of, you know, a gathering place for Native Americans, of contact period, of, you know, big folks like Father Marquette and all that, that coming through, the wars and all the various things there tied in with this great natural history resource that's on the island in terms of, you know, our second national park, which then was given to the state of Michigan as our first state park. There's just a ton of interesting things there. And so a rainy day for us up there is just a bonus of trying to sit down and think about all that we've seen on other days.
And Barbara, how did that great idea turn into a board game? Actually, five games in one, correct?
We've got the card game that a bright seven-year-old could play, and then all the way up to the treasure hunt game, which is pretty difficult. Even college-age students have found it challenging. And so there's something for everybody.
Jim, what are some of the other games?
Well, it starts with a basic card game that gives you a chance to kind of collect sets of things that are common, like, you know, plants, animals, and that kind of thing. And then the first board game is a nature hike game, which basically gives you the feeling of, you know, kind of walking down a trail on the island, maybe, you know, seeing a flash of red out of the corner of your eye and hearing a cuck-cuck-cuck sound of a bird, and then you get to see a like a pileated woodpecker and then score 2 points from that. So that was what we were trying to do with the nature hike game, is really you know, give people the feeling of going on a nature hike on the island. There's a cooperative game that we call the scavenger hunt, where people are trying to find a series of historical treasures around the island before the season changes to winter. There's a memory game where you travel around the island, and every time you move to a new place, you can reveal a hidden historical treasure. And then the last game is what we call the treasure hunt game, which is sort of like Clue, I guess. You could tell each of the players has a treasure hidden around the island, and you have to ask them open-ended yes or no questions about where their treasure is, what the treasure is that they've hidden. And then if you can find it, then you score a bunch of points that way. So those are the general overview of the five games.
Barb, besides something fun and educational to do if you get reined in at the cottage up north, what do you hope people will get out of playing Mackinac Island Treasure Hunt?
Well, one of the ideas that I've had all along is to try to get kids away from the computer screen for a while. The board game, by virtue of playing it, it teaches people social skills, but our game specifically focuses on nature appreciation, nature observation, and natural history. And it sort of bridges the gap, I would say, between nature and technology. So many kids are addicted to gadgets and digital ways of learning, and I just feel that we just need to get kids back connected to nature and working in social ways with other people.
Jim, how about you? What do you hope people will get out of your game?
We really want to help people understand that there's a deep history and lots of interesting stories about the places that are right close by here in northern Michigan. Pretty much every place has a real interesting story to tell, and so we hope that through this game, folks will realize the real diversity of the natural history on the island, but then also it's a really important place in the human history of the development of this whole region.
The Mackinac Island Board Game, and you can get information at mackinactreasure.com. Thanks to Barbara Overdeer and Jim Moratsky, the creators of the game. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Welcome back to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. As the baby boom generation gets older, more and more attention is shifting to the millennials. Those 18 to 34 years old are expected to exert growing influence on politics as their voting bloc takes up a larger share of the electorate. Curtis Audette is president of the Michigan Federation of College Democrats, and he's a senior at Michigan State University. Welcome, Curtis.
Thank you for having me, Cynthia.
And Connor Walby is the campaign manager for Republican State Representative Frank Foster in Michigan's 17th district. Connor has also interned for various conservative representatives on the state and the federal level. Connor Walby, good to have you with us.
Thanks for having me on today.
You are both very, very active politically, but that's not so much the case amongst everyone in your generation. We saw one statistic that said something like 19% of millennials voted in the last election. Why do you think this voter apathy exists as compared with older voters? Connor, I'll let you take it first.
Absolutely. Well, I think with our generation and having Twitter, Facebook, and the like, is we're blasted with a lot of the 24-hour media cycle. And with that, you also get a lot of the negative news coverage. I think a lot of our generation is pretty sick and tired of some of the policies that have been put in place and are just sick of the politicians and the political atmosphere in general. I think with that being said, they're probably a little bit more involved in stuff like BuzzFeed and stuff that is more entertaining rather than getting into politics, especially with the job market out there. I think people are a little bit more concerned about how they're going to find a job than rather what the government's role is in that.
So I hear you saying people might more tend to jump into BuzzFeed to read some funny listicle than kind of plunge into political discourse.
Absolutely. And BuzzFeed does a very good job of also jumping into the political discourse, mm-hmm. but at the same time, it does have a negative connotation for the most part. So again, that's kind of reiterating, and you kind of get this loop of, you know, the negative aspects of politics. Now, that could be a good thing if people are motivated, like myself and a few others, to get involved in that. However, I feel that a lot of our generation, given the connectivity and the globalization of our culture, we feel that as one voice, as a younger person, we don't have a lot of say in politics. And I think that also drives their decision to remain out of the discussion as well.
Curtis Audette, what's your take?
Well, I definitely agree. Negative campaigning, and especially negative messaging, tends to turn off millennial voters. The amount of inaction in Washington is seen as a direct consequence of partisan bickering. Millennials are more skeptical of negative ads and messaging because they want to hear why they should vote for a candidate and not necessarily why not. And so, like, when I'm organizing on my campus, I want a fellow classmate or student to understand that it's not about the importance of voting, but rather the importance of being a voter. And that's when I have discussions with these voters, and we often discuss values we share, whether it be equal protections for everyone or protecting our environment. And if we want to, like, advance these values, we need to support candidates who share these same ideals. And that's really what kind of just turns that discussion, and it makes them want to become maybe a little more active and see that they actually have a voice and can change something.
Who do you think should or could change this feeling overall of apathy and cynicism? By that, I'm wondering, do you think it's the politicians? For example, we saw young voters really rallied for Barack Obama in 08. Or would it be political parties themselves, like the Young Democrats or the Young Republicans on college campuses and university campuses? So who should be changing this? Connor?
Yeah, in my opinion, I really think it's the politicians. And this kind of goes back to Curtis's point about engagement. If you look at some of the best companies, the best brands across the world, they do something very well to our generation, and that is communicate and engage. If I tweet at Nordstrom's, at Delta Airlines about a bad service or about my great service, you know, there might be a chance that they talk to me and they engage back, and that's going to send a really good message not only to me but to all my followers and all to theirs. So for politicians to really take the key on this and kind of go with it, kind of take the ball and run. If they can start engaging us, millennial voters, on Twitter, Facebook, even Instagram, and they can kind of communicate back just as much as Curtis said, I think that's going to really change our attitude about the cynicism and about our doubts about politics and about politicians themselves.
Curtis, I'll let you jump in.
Definitely. I agree. One of the issues that I have, and I'm sure Connor understands too, is that all of our candidates and political parties, they have a hard time engaging and communicating with millennials and with young voters, and there really isn't a message that's geared towards them. And most of it's because there is this apathy and cynicism amongst our age group. and both parties know they have a demographic issue. It might lean more towards liberal as far as people wanting to vote that way. But I remember looking back, the RNC in March unveiled a new ad that was intended to appeal towards millennials. And one of the ads features a young man who feels lucky for having a job, but he also notes that many of his friends are unemployed. And he continues to say that he is a Republican because you can't help the unemployed by hurting the people who could employ them with regulations. And so some of the nationwide surveys that we see show millennials want government on their side instead of being off their back. So asking a little more from the wealthy in order to invest in job creation is more than an empty promise. It's a sound economic policy for millennials. And I think millennials have a problem supporting a candidate or a party that would rather hand over a problem to a middleman in hopes of creating change when they would rather see a direct action towards the issues they care about and the values they hold. And unfortunately, our candidates and our political parties aren't necessarily gearing us up towards that or trying to engage with us as much as they should be.
And I hear both of you saying this is something you see on the right and the left equally. And I'm betting some of that is you have older folks running who don't quite get the way to use the social media that speaks to your generation.
Exactly. I think one of the things we saw in 2012 and in even 2008, Barack Obama and his campaign, they really championed getting millennials out to vote by using social media, especially with things like graphics, using Twitter, using Instagram, all sorts of these social media tools that millennials use as a way of engaging with other people. And that's especially like where I'm starting to see campaigns in that go is they're all trying to get on Facebook and Twitter, and that's how they're going to be able to engage millennial voters coming this next election.
Connor, is it a big push for you to try to get folks to kind of see this on the conservative side?
You know, absolutely. And Curtis raised a great point about Barack Obama engaging people and getting his voters to turn out over Twitter. I think one of the most memorable or things that stood out to me was he tweeted a picture of him and his wife hugging, I believe, right around election time, and it was one of the most retweeted pictures of all time since Twitter created. So for me, and as a conservative, I want to see my party start to build that up. And I think during the McCain election, they didn't have any clue what they were doing, but during the Romney election, they started to get a hang of it, and it's definitely a work in progress. And so I think what we need to do is start like the graphics that Curtis mentioned. I think those are very important to reach out to millennial voters and keep going and keep engaging them. Because if we can get, you know, a young, fresh-looking candidate or young, fresh-looking graphics that engage millennial voters, I think it's really going to start to, turn heads. Unfortunately, people don't like graphs, and that's a lot of what the Republican Party likes to put out there. So I think there needs to be a balance of showing real-life people and with economic and GDP and graphical data.
If you've just joined us, we're talking about what it will take to appeal to millennial voters, to kind of shake them out of that apathy and get them politically active. We're speaking with Connor Walby, who's campaign manager for Republican State Representative Frank Foster in Michigan's 107th District. He also has interned for various conservative representatives on the state and the federal level. And we're speaking with Curtis Audette. Curtis is the president of the Michigan Federation of College Democrats. He's a senior at Michigan State University. Curtis, what do you feel are some of the issues that really matter most to millennials? And feel free to kind of take that into specific Michigan issues, too.
Yeah, definitely. Millennials, I think you see that, I believe the statistic is 7 in 10 millennials are for same-sex marriage and want it legalized. You see more millennials who are concerned about their college debt and that being an inability for them to purchase a home or being able to buy a car and really participate in the economy. And then also, too, things such as like the decriminalization of marijuana. These are all issues that tend to engage people. And one of the things that I've noticed in my experience is organizing is that ballot proposals and initiatives can really bring out young voters to vote. The kind of turnout we might see would be based on those topics such as the legalization of same-sex marriage or the decriminalization of marijuana. Because millennials see this as an opportunity or chance to personally create change and enact direct action.
A clear-cut yes or no, it can happen or it cannot happen based on what I do.
Exactly.
All right. And from the other side?
Well, I think really for Michigan
college graduates and millennial voters, I really think they're concerned about getting a jobs. And luckily in the past 4 years, we've had a great governor and a great state legislature on both the Senate and the House sides that have really boosted our economy. You know, you have state entities like the MEDC, which is both loved and hated by both sides, but they have tried to engage in with this Michigan Business Connect. They are trying to get voters out there and to get a job. And I think if you're graduating college, you have student loan debt, if you're from Michigan, you know, do you want to stay in Michigan? Do you have other states that you are looking at to get a job? So I think the real big issue is getting a job. And I'm not going to knock decriminalizing marijuana or same-sex marriage, but I think a lot of the millennial voters are looking at this debt that they've accumulated and wanting to get that job so that they can start a career, not only one, and two, to start paying off that debt.
And just final thoughts, we've touched on it earlier in our conversation, but I feel free to go a little deeper with this. Knowing that we have elections coming up in November, entire state house and Senate, the governor, the secretary of state, attorney general, not to mention local campaigns and issues. I will start with Curtis. Tell us what you believe the smart political candidate will say and do to appeal to a millennial voter.
It's about having discussions with a lot of these college students about, you know, what direction do they want to see the state or the country or their local municipality take, and what can we do to make sure that they stay here in Michigan and want to grow and have a family, and issues like making sure that college is affordable and something that every student can reach if they want to do. And so that's what candidates are going to have to talk about and really engage students in other ways that they may not have had in the past.
And for the conservative view, Connor Walby?
Absolutely. I think you turn to how the unemployment rate has gone down in the past years, as well as the number of jobs that have grown, and specifically the type of jobs. There was a report, I think, came out this past week from the MEDC that stated that jobs are, you know, high-paying jobs are coming, that Silicon Valley, Detroit is becoming, or will become a home for venture capitalists and newfound technologies and startups and buildups. I mean, that's what our core is. That's what Detroit has always been about. It's about the rough and tough, the nitty-gritty, the startups. So I think you really play on that the business atmosphere in Michigan is going to be better than it has ever before. And I think, again, you just got to talk and engage and resound with these points. And that career opportunities are available here in Michigan, and they're good career opportunities. And what we've done in the past, the governor and the state house and the state senate, you know, in those particular offices, I would just, again, hate what they have done. They've cut Michigan business tax, personal property taxes have gone down, they've passed right to work. So I think if you hit on all those things and you show them how they're affecting them and their career opportunities, I really think that the millennial voter will vote for you. However, that is all dependent on if you're engaged with them in the ways that we talk, which is in hashtags and tweets.
Connor Walby, campaign manager for Republican State Representative Frank Foster in Michigan's 17th District, and Curtis Audette, president of the Michigan Federation of College Democrats. It was a good conversation with both of you, and thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Thank you for having me on.
It has been known for decades as the world's largest walled prison, Southern Michigan Prison in Jackson. Now some of the very colorful stories from that prison and from Jackson are being told in the new Cell Block 7 Prison Museum. It's a joint venture of the Ellis Sharp Museum and the Michigan Department of Corrections. The museum is actually renting the 7-block portion of the prison to use it for an historical prison museum. MLive writer Leanne Smith is here. What does this new museum cover?
Well, we've had a prison in Jackson since 1838. The original prison was closer to downtown, but they outgrew that space, so they moved out north of town in Blackman Township to where the current prison is. And this museum sort of covers that whole 176-year history of the prison and the people who were there. It's a residence, so to speak, and as well as its wardens and its guards.
It is an interesting idea to have it at the prison.
not just somewhere in town. It certainly hammers at home, doesn't it?
It does, and it is an actual cell block. You walk in and you have no doubt as to where you are.
There are so many interesting people and stories that came out of Southern Michigan Prison. Members of the Purple Gang ended up in the prison. That Purple Gang was a mob of bootleggers that was even referenced in Elvis Presley's monster hit Jailhouse Rock. And then in 1967, munitions stored at the prison exploded and killed two officers, and that led to prison munitions and storage reform. But for a lot of us who grew up in Michigan, it was the great helicopter escape of 1975. It was pretty astounding. A helicopter lowered itself right into the prison yard.
Yes, yes. I mean, we've had a lot of crazy escapes from Southern Michigan Prison throughout its history. But Dale Remling's helicopter escape in 1975, it was June 1975, was, you know, probably goes down in history as the most dramatic, daring escape. A helicopter, it just basically swooped into the prison yard. It was a hijacked helicopter, mind you, and was, you know, forced to swoop into the prison yard where Mr. Remling hopped inside and they took off. And then the helicopter landed down the road right in a field alongside, and, you know, the Remling and his conspirators, they escaped. And he was on the lam for about 30 hours, I guess, before he was captured in a bar in Leslie, which is north of Jackson.
He didn't get very far. You would have thought he would have made, they would have hijacked it and said, go further. Go a lot further than a nearby field. What was he in? What was he doing time for?
He was a con man.
Interesting, yeah, interesting. And there's so many other stories.
There's three inmates who escaped by crawling underneath a guard tower and cutting through the wire because the guard couldn't, from that vantage point, couldn't see them. And they holed up in the abandoned poorhouse in Jackson for quite a while until they were eventually caught.
Well, it certainly is something that could give us all a much better understanding of Southern Michigan Prison, really the Jackson area and its role in Michigan. It's the new Cell Block 7 Prison Museum, and it's a joint venture of the Ella Sharp Museum and the Michigan Department of Corrections. And there it is, the museum renting the 7-block portion of Southern Michigan Prison, so you will get to really get a sense of what it was like to be behind bars in Jackson. Interesting stuff. Thank you so much. We've been talking with writer Leanne Smith. Thank you, Leanne.
Well, thank you. It's been a pleasure.
Today's Stateside was directed by Mercedes Mejia. Our executive producer is Zoe Clark. Our engineer is Bob Scon. Contributors are Allie Billings, Emily Fox, Taylor Mattia, Kayla Steinberg, Katie Suha, and Brianna Tinsley. Support for arts and culture coverage on Stateside comes in part from the Michigan Council for Arts and Cultural Affairs and the National Endowment for the Arts. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thank you so much for listening.